Kerfall 1916.
I. You ought to buy it, said my host, it's just the place for a solitary mind, a devil like you. And it would be rather worthwhile to own the most romantic house in Brittany. The present people are dead broke, and it's going for a song, you ought to buy it. It was not with the least idea of living up to the character my friend Lan Riving ascribed to me. As a matter of fact, under my unsociable exterior I have always had secret yearnings for domesticity, that I took his hint one autumn afternoon and went to Kerfall. My friend was motoring over to Camper on business, he dropped me on the way, at a crossroad on a heath, and said, first turn to the right and second to the left. Then straight ahead till you see an avenue. If you meet any peasants, don't ask your way. They don't understand French, and they would pretend they did and mix you up. I'll be back for you here by sunset, and don't forget the tombs in the chapel. I followed Lan Riving's directions with the hesitation occasioned by the usual difficulty of remembering whether he had said the first turn to the right and second to the left, or the contrary. If I had met a peasant I should certainly have asked, and probably been sent astray, but I had the desert landscape to myself, and so stumbled on the right turn and walked across the heath till I came to an avenue. It was so unlike any other avenue I have ever seen that I instantly knew it must be the avenue. The great trunk trees sprang up straight to a great height and then interwove their pale gray branches in a long tunnel through which the autumn light fell faintly. I know most trees by name, but I haven't to this day been able to decide what those trees were. They had the tall curve of elms, the tenuity of poplars, the ashen color of olives under a rainy sky, and they stretched ahead of me for half a mile or more without a break in their arch. If ever I saw an avenue that unmistakably led to something, it was the avenue at Kerfall. My heart beat a little as I began to walk down it. Presently the trees ended and I came to a fortified gate in a long wall. Between me and the wall was an open space of grass, with other gray avenues radiating from it. Behind the wall were tall slate roofs mossed with silver, a chapel belfry, the top of a keep. A moat filled with wild shrubs and brambles surrounded the place, the drawbridge had been replaced by a stone arch, and the portcullis by an iron gate. I stood for a long time on the hither side of the moat, gazing about me, and letting the influence of the place sink in. I said to myself, if I wait long enough, the guardian will turn up and show me the tombs, and I rather hoped he wouldn't turn up too soon. I sat down on a stone and lit a cigarette. As soon as I had done it, it struck me as a puerile and portentous thing to do, with that great blind house looking down at me, and all the empty avenues converging on me. It may have been the depth of the silence that made me so conscious of my gesture. The squeak of my match sounded as loud as the scraping of a brake, and I almost fancied I heard it fall when I tossed it onto the grass. But there was more than that, a sense of irrelevance, of littleness, of futile bravado, in sitting there puffing my cigarette smoke into the face of such a past. I knew nothing of the history of Kerfall, I was new to Brittany, and Lan Riving had never mentioned the name to me till the day before, but one couldn't as much as glance at that pile without feeling in it a long accumulation of history. What kind of history I was not prepared to guess, perhaps only that sheer weight of many associated lives and deaths which gives a majesty to all old houses. But the aspect of Kerfall suggested something more, a perspective of stern and cruel memories stretching away, like its own gray avenues, into a blur of darkness. Certainly no house had ever more completely and finally broken with the present. As it stood there, lifting its proud roofs and gables to the sky, it might have been its own funeral monument. Tombs in the chapel? The whole place is a tomb. I reflected. I hoped more and more that the guardian would not come. The details of the place, however striking, would seem trivial compared with its collective impressiveness, and I wanted only to sit there and be penetrated by the weight of its silence. It's the very place for you, Lan Riving had said, and I was overcome by the almost blasphemous frivolity of suggesting to any living being that Kerfall was the place for him. Is it possible that anyone could not see? I wondered. I did not finish the thought, what I meant was undefinable. I stood up and wandered toward the gate. I was beginning to want to know more, not to see more, I was by now so sure it was not a question of seeing, but to feel more, feel all the place had to communicate. But to get in one will have to rout out the keeper, I thought reluctantly, and hesitated. Finally I crossed the bridge and tried the iron gate. It yielded, and I walked through the tunnel formed by the thickness of the chemin de ronde. At the farther end, a wooden barricade had been laid across the entrance, and beyond it was a court enclosed in noble architecture. The main building faced me, and I now saw that one half was a mere ruined front, with gaping windows through which the wild growths of the moat and the trees of the park were visible. The rest of the house was still in its robust beauty. One end abutted on the round tower, the other on the small traceried chapel, and in an angle of the building stood a graceful wellhead crowned with mossy urns. A few roses grew against the walls, and on an upper windowsill I remember noticing a pot of fuchsias. My sense of the pressure of the invisible began to yield to my architectural interest. The building was so fine that I felt a desire to explore it for its own sake. I looked about the court, wondering in which corner the guardian lodged. Then I pushed open the barrier and went in. As I did so, a dog barred my way. He was such a remarkably beautiful little dog that for a moment he made me forget the splendid place he was defending. I was not sure of his breed at the time, but have since learned that it was Chinese, and that he was of a rare variety called the sleeve dog. He was very small and golden brown, with large brown eyes and a ruffled throat. He looked like a large tawny chrysanthemum. I said to myself, these little beasts always snap and scream, and somebody will be out in a minute. The little animal stood before me, forbidding, almost menacing. There was anger in his large brown eyes. But he made no sound, he came no nearer. Instead, as I advanced, he gradually fell back, and I noticed that another dog, a vague rough brindled thing, had limped up on a lame leg. There'll be a hubbub now, I thought, for at the same moment a third dog, a long-haired white mongrel, slipped out of a doorway and joined the others. All three stood looking at me with grave eyes, but not a sound came from them. As I advanced they continued to fall back on muffled paws, still watching me. At a given point, they'll all charge at my ankles. It's one of the jokes that dogs who live together put up on one, I thought. I was not alarmed, for they were neither large nor formidable. But they let me wander about the court as I pleased.